Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and novelist, Allison Lurie. Lurie has published 10 novels, several books of nonfiction, and three collections of tales for children. Her novels include Truth and Consequences, The War Between the Tates, and Foreign Affairs, for which she received the Pulitzer Prize. Her most recent book, and what we'll be discussing today, is a new work of nonfiction entitled The Language of Houses, How Buildings Speak to Us. It was published by Delphinium Books on August 19th, and welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Now, Allison, to tell us how you came up with the thought behind the subtitle of this book, How Buildings Speak to Us. Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, I came up with it because I wanted to tell people it's not just about houses. This book is also about schools, churches, stores, offices, public buildings, and libraries. And I wanted people to know that this. And then the book is about what we feel when we go into a building or a room, what these places are telling us. And they are speaking to us silently, of course, and we're picking up their messages, though often unconsciously. But it's like, for instance, you meet someone new, and you go to their house for the first time, and you feel, wow, this is nice. I'd love to live here myself. And that's a very good sign. Or maybe you feel, gee, I wouldn't have expected her to have this kind of a kitchen. And that means that there's something going on that you don't understand. But people usually don't go beyond that. They don't stop and think, what is it? What's happening here? What is it that makes me uncomfortable? So I tried to investigate what these signs are, why we pick up on certain signs, why we feel as we do about any building or any house.
Yeah, and you know, this is, like you said, it's more than just about buildings. It seems to encompass sociology and cultural touchstones. It's a very fascinating book. It sort of read like a novel for me. I found it really exciting. Now, you do devote several chapters to private homes and people's lives within
yes.
them. And,
mm-hmm.
and you say that we can pick up on whether somebody's happy or unhappy or rich or poor or nouveau rich. Talk
yeah.
to us more about
yeah.
some of that.
There's signs that, I mean, untidiness and confusion is often a sign of unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
That you just don't have the energy to tidy up, and you've lost your umbrella, and it's probably somewhere in the house, but you just can't find it, so you go out in the rain, and you get wet, and one thing leads to another. I was thinking just the other day, it occurred to me that it would be interesting to ask people, what is it about your house you'd change if you could? If you, you know, cost is no consideration. What would you do with your house? How would you change your house? And I thought, well, what about mine? I would move it back from the road because it's an old farmhouse that was built too near the road when the road was probably just a dirt road with grass growing in it. And
for horses and buggies and stuff, right? Don't you think it was for horses and buggies? And
for horses and buggies.
Cars?
You didn't,
mm-hmm.
And you didn't have to, since the road was quiet, you didn't have to shovel too much snow if you were built near the road. And the other thing I'd like is a bigger dining room and a bigger sitting room so I could have a lot more people over because with more than 6 or 7 people, it begins to look crowded. And I thought, well, this is interesting. And really, what I'm talking about is how I'd like to change my life.
Ah,
I'd like to mm-hmm. be a little more private, especially since Hanshaw Road is covered with road building equipment, has been all this summer and all last summer. But I'd also like to have more friends around. And this is true because a lot of my friends have moved away from Ithaca or died.
And yeah, yeah.
So I think this is interesting to ask that. How would you change, if you could change your house?
I would want a bigger house. You know, we have a small house up on West Hill. I would want more space.
Yeah.
Space for an office so I could have more privacy and, you know, things like that. We have a beautiful big yard, which I would be fine to keep that way.
We have a beautiful
big
yard too, but with the Ithaca weather, it's only available part of the year.
That's right. That's right. Do you think, when you say that sometimes when people's houses are messy or disheveled, do you think some of it's eccentricity, though, instead of somebody being unhappy? Did you ever think
I think it depends.
I think
it's a kind of messiness where the person who lives there can actually find anything. They just don't want to bother putting it away in a drawer. That's a very different feeling. It's a sitting room with piles of books on the coffee table and piles of DVDs on the floor, maybe next to the player. That's a very different feeling. It's just somebody who's living a rich, full life and doesn't have time for neatness.
That's right, Tell us about the evolution of the drawing room, because I thought that was really interesting when you brought that up. In the 19th century, it seemed more formal, and people have certainly read about drawing rooms in many novels.
Yes.
So tell us about the metamorphosis.
Well, the drawing room, which we've all seen on shows like Downton Abbey, was a formal room. If you were rich, you not only had a drawing room for formal social events, you had a morning room where your friends would come and see you, and you very often had a sitting room upstairs. And if you had a female friend come over to visit you, you'd spend your time in the upstairs sitting room. Downstairs, it was formal. The chairs were far apart, so you couldn't really have an intimate conversation. Everything was very beautiful, but it wasn't cozy. But upstairs, you'd have a room which was cozy. So if you weren't rich, you'd probably have a sewing room, and it would be the same thing. You know, they had a little sofa and a sewing machine, and that's where you'd spend your time, and you'd read and sew and gossip.
But that started changing in the 60s. You talk about how people brought in coffee tables and people were able to put their feet up and be more informal.
That's right.
And we don't call them drawing rooms anymore.
We don't call them. And drawing room is a shortening of the word withdrawing room.
Uh-huh.
And it was where, after a big formal dinner party, the women would all get up and withdraw. And the first time I was in England, they still had this custom. And I went to a dinner party, and at one point, the hostess looked around the room at all the women, and she said, "Shall we?" And I didn't know what that meant, but they all stood up, and she went like this, so I stood up. And we all went upstairs into her little sitting room.
That is funny.
And the men stayed down below and passed the port, I guess. I don't know. I wasn't there.
That is funny, that formality and the separation of the sexes. Now, something that has always fascinated me since I was a kid, you talk about haunted houses and haunted hospitals and haunted psychiatric hospitals. Talk to us more about that. Do you believe in this?
I don't really believe that there are ghosts there, but I think if we know certain things about a place, we're going to pick up on an atmosphere that makes us uneasy. I mean, my husband went up to Willard State, where as an undergraduate he was a volunteer when it was a psychiatric hospital.
Yeah.
And I went up there when I was writing a book about people who believed in flying saucers, and because I had seen set in that kind of facility, and because I knew what had happened there, I got these strange, sad, confused feelings, and I don't know whether they were really there or whether I was projecting them, but that sort of thing does happen. On the other hand, as I said in my book, there are haunted bed and breakfasts, and there's a haunted Toys R Us in Texas, I believe.
How would
something like that get haunted? Maybe something bad happened there, and people knew about it, and for them, it was haunted.
Yeah, and a lot of people think they see the ghost of Dylan Thomas and Eugene O'Neill at the Chelsea Hotel in New York. And
well,
there have been stories about that.
It would be fun, yeah.
You quote the famous landscape designer Andrew Jackson Downing, who said that it was possible to control behavior via architecture. Tell us more about that.
To control us from architecture?
Yeah, he said that it was possible to control behavior through architecture.
Yes, I think it is to some extent. I mean, one very simple example is grocery stores and supermarkets always put the milk and the eggs in the back corner. That's so we have to walk all that way past other things that we don't want. And they've proved through studies that if we do spend more time and walk further, we will buy more things.
Yeah. So it's psychology,
And they're
too.
Deliberately controlling our behavior. They're even controlling the behavior of our kids because the sugary cereals with the cute pictures on the cover are placed at the level of a child sitting in a shopping cart so that this kid can see these pictures and start howling for the cereal. So our behavior is deliberately controlled this way. And I think it isn't always commercial. For instance, old-fashioned schools used to have rows of desks. Sometimes they were even bolted to the floor. And kids were supposed to sit facing front, looking at the teacher. They weren't supposed to lean over and speak to their friends. Mm-hmm. The schoolroom was designed to create this kind of behavior, or at least control the misbehavior.
Uh-huh.
Nowadays, classrooms mostly have movable tables and chairs. And what happens is kids work on projects together in groups, and they move from one group to another. And I think that we're producing people who are going to be used to working in groups and aren't going to be afraid that if they speak to a friend, they'll be sent to sit in the corner.
Yeah, so they're teaching kids to be more socialized.
Much more socialized. It trains people to work in groups once they go into a job.
Yeah. I think it probably is a better way. And you also talk about doctor's offices and hospitals and how that, you know, the little outfits that we have to put on in doctor's offices make us revert back to a childlike state.
Yes, I really
helpless.
I really think that's why we have to wear these awful hospital gowns, which you can't even... You can't tie the bow behind your back. You can do the one behind your neck. But after that, it's just flapping open. And what it looks like is these little wrappers you put on a baby in a hospital.
Yeah.
I think it's very insulting, really. And I've often thought that if I get my nerve up, next time I'm in a hospital, I'm going to refuse. What will they do? Maybe they'll send me to the psychiatric ward. I just don't know.
I've refused to put those on in doctor's offices.
You do?
I do. I refuse. They say, okay. They can't make you do it. I mean,
doctor doesn't ask me to do that.
But I don't know how much control you'd have in a hospital. I think a bunch of nurses would come at you at a hospital.
They would come at you. They would be... they would think that you would be a threat to their system. Because they want to make you feel helpless and obedient.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier for them if you're helpless and obedient.
Yeah. But it makes you wonder, I mean, that's a whole other subject about why they're so insecure.
What?
Why doctors and medical people are so insecure that they need to make patients vulnerable and childlike, you know? That's a whole other subject.
You could ask a doctor or a nurse. I think some things are changing, though. They don't all do this anymore.
Tell us if you found any surprises while you were researching this book. Was there anything in some of your studies that really shocked you?
One of my big surprises was when I hired some Cornell students to do research for me. And, for instance, I printed out pictures of different styles of houses. There was a ranch house, there was a Victorian's house, there was a modern house, there was a colonial house, there was an old farmhouse, and so on. And I got them to show these pictures to a large group of people, both their friends at Cornell and then their parents and their neighbors back home. And I thought probably it wouldn't work. They'd say, well, gee, I don't know. And I told my students, ask them, which of these houses would you like to live in? And then which would you least like to live in? And then, who do you think lives in each of these houses? I thought they'd say, well, gee, I don't know, or I don't know, my uncle has a house kind of like this one, but they wouldn't be. But no, they knew instantly. They were full of opinions. They said, for instance, that the nicest house was the old farmhouse with the big front porch. That's where they wanted to live. They didn't want to live in the modern house, except for a small group of architecture students.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and novelist Alison Lurie. We're talking about her new book of nonfiction, The Language of Houses, How Buildings Speak to Us. Do you want to continue on that conversation about what the students reacted to?
Well, my students, who had asked their friends and their family what kind of house they want to live in, I was surprised that none of my students wanted to live in a modern house. They wanted to live in an old-fashioned farmhouse with a big front porch, or a colonial, and a modern colonial, or an ancient colonial. And they didn't want to live in a McMansion. In fact, they said mean things about people who live in McMansions.
Ah.
They said these people are pretentious, and one of them said, probably these people are dishonest and they're running some sort of scam or racket.
Wow.
I was amazed by this. And then they said in the Victorian house, arty people, people live who love the arts, music and dance and theater and maybe they do some of this themselves, or maybe they just like to go to the opera. So they invented lives for people in these really very simple drawings. And the people in the ranch house, they said either they were a young couple on their way up, or they were an older couple on their way down. So obviously, even kids who are not themselves thinking about buying a house at their age in Cornell, they have ideas about them, and they're very sure of what the meanings are.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of kids nowadays are looking for comfort in places where they feel safe.
I think the world is very frightening now.
Mm-hmm.
People are looking for comfort and safety and affection, all those things.
You have a chapter about bars and restaurants and what we now call coffee houses. And you've made this observation that coffee houses serve sweet drinks and bright colors and cookies and cupcakes, and it's reminiscent of childhood birthday parties. I had never thought of that.
Yes, I think that's true. And even the coffee has whipped cream and chocolate in it and a lot of the times. And it's a place you can go. For example, if you're a woman alone or a woman with another woman, you can go into these places. Whereas there are a lot of bars that a woman feels uncomfortable in, and these bars signal this. I don't know if it's consciously, but any bar that has neon beer signs in the window, that is a sign that if you only go there if you're a woman, if you're looking to pick up somebody, and maybe professionally.
So do you feel comfortable in coffee houses, I take it, right?
Yeah, but I feel comfortable in coffee houses, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you have a large bibliography in this book, but did you go visit places? And you talk about museums, you talk about hospitals, as
we said. I read lots and lots of books, and one of my students went through magazines that they got onto from the Cornell environmental design people, and you can go on to the web and find a list of articles that were published in these magazines, and they came to me with these lists, and they read them or looked at them, and then I read them. And then I just asked everybody, people in human ecology, people in anthropology, helped me out, let me sit in on their courses. Gary Evans in housing and design, he was wonderful. And several, Bonnie McDougall in anthropology, she helped me a lot,
yeah,
telling me books I should look up and places I should go.
Uh-huh. And you obviously use some of your own experience, right? I mean, some of your analysis has to do with how you react to houses and hospitals.
It's not all out of books and articles. A lot of it I just plain made up.
Do you find yourself when you're visiting buildings being hyper aware of how they're making you feel?
While I was writing the book, I was. I think I've rather stopped now. Since I'm running around talking about it, I think I'm more aware again.
Mm-hmm. What atmosphere? You know, everybody I know says atmospheres, like certain grocery stores creep them out,
certain little tiny
libraries creep them out. Just little tiny grocery stores that look like they're not very well stocked or not very clean.
You feel that. Yes, I know people who won't go into a dollar store because they think that the things in there might have measles or something.
You know? But do you think that's class
prejudice,
though?
I don't think that's true. I got a most wonderful scarf in a dollar store. But on the other hand, I wouldn't buy a can of tomato soup in a dollar store.
No, I wouldn't buy food in a dollar store.
It had expired. It was a can of tomato soup that ought to have a funeral, you know.
Now, reading your book got me to thinking about our actual cultural landscape nowadays. Not many people seem to be looking around them and paying attention. They're looking at their little screens, their little phones. So did you write this book hoping that would make people wake up and look at the world around them more?
Oh, yes, because it's fun to look at the world around you, and it's useful, too. Because just as in the language of houses, when I was talking about it, I said, if you go to a party and you don't know anybody, you should look for someone whose clothes you'd be willing to wear and approach them, and they'll probably be a potential friend. Uh-huh. And the same is true of houses and offices. If you feel really comfortable in the space that someone has arranged for themselves, you'll probably get on with them well.
Mm-hmm. To talk to us a little bit about art galleries. You have a whole chapter on art galleries and museums and about how the art gallery evolved and so people's paintings and people's artwork changed because of the white cube movement and so on. Talk to us about that.
Something that happened in the late 20th century is that art started getting bigger. A beautiful painting of the 18th century, unless it's a mural, you know, is probably going to be of limited size. The masterpieces of Impressionism, they're really, none of them is as big as an ordinary door.
Yeah, I know. I was shocked when I went to the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam and how
small. These people, now, of course, their paintings are huge. Artists get annoyed by this because if they don't make these huge paintings, they have trouble getting a show. And if they do get a show in one of these huge white-walled museums, their painting looks like a little smudge on the wall.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in fact, I've seen museums now, contemporary, very modern museums, in which you could put a beautiful Rembrandt or Van Gogh on the wall, and nobody would see it.
Yeah.
Because next to it would be a 10-feet-high painting of polka dots. Is that Damien Hirst?
Yeah. It could be.
Or a huge sculpture of a balloon dog. And everyone would be looking at these immense objects. Of course, this also means that there can't be as many artists, because if you need that much space for your art, only a few of you can get in.
Yeah, yeah. I had never thought about that, though. The way that art galleries were designed, especially starting in the 20th century, had changed the way people made art. I hadn't thought of it that way.
It's certainly true. Now, if you go to the Met, for instance, they still have galleries that look like 19th or 20th century galleries, where wonderful 18th, 19th century paintings look wonderful. And they have had the sense, mostly, not to put these paintings into huge white boxes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they do, and it's a very they look very unhappy there.
Yeah. To talk to us, you have a chapter about prisons and places of confinement. To talk to us about prisons, they don't seem to be conducive to what we consider rehabilitation, which is what originally they were supposed to be. Talk to us about what you found out about them.
Well, people who are in charge of prisons usually have a very cynical attitude toward rehabilitation. They don't think that these guys, and they are mostly guys, of course, are going to reform. So they don't want to make their lives very pleasant. And these guys are giving them a hard time, so they're giving both them a hard time. And they'll sometimes deliberately make things uncomfortable and make the chairs in the dining hall uncomfortable and the beds hard. And
there's a lacking of light, and there's ugly,
light.
artificial light.
You can't see out. And I think in some cases this is deliberate. On the other hand, there are places like hospitals which want the patients to feel good and get better, and they've begun changing because of some of these studies I read, which one famous one, for instance, proved that if you're in a hospital
like
room with a window, you get better faster.
Oh, yeah, I'll
and it
bet.
Doesn't matter what you have or how old you are or what race or sex you are. If you have a window, you get better. And, of course, hospitals want people to get better because the hospital makes money on the sickest people. That's why when I had my children, I was we were all allowed and encouraged to stay in the hospital for a week. But now they turn you out as fast as possible because if you're just lying there in good shape, eating and taking up a bed, you're not very profitable. So they send you home very early, I think too early.
Yeah, for
especially
some things.
If you've got other kids at home.
Well, Allison, we're almost out of time. Are you working on anything new? Do you have any new books?
I do, but I usually don't talk about them.
You don't like to talk about them?
No.
But I'm wondering, just for my own self, are we going to see another novel from Allison Lurie sometime?
Well, I wish I could think of it. If I could think of one, I'd certainly write it, yes.
So that's not out of the question, right? Because
no.
You haven't written a novel for quite a while.
I know. Well, I haven't had an idea for quite a while.
So that explains it. Are you going on any tour with this book? Are you going to be giving any readings?
Not much. I'm going to Albany because I'm just coming off being the Albany state writer, and I'm going to New York, and I'm going to Connecticut, but nothing much. I don't. It's so hard to leave Ithaca these days. I don't know if you noticed that.
It's beautiful, yeah.
I mean, you can only fly to Newark, and very often the plane doesn't go.
Well, Allison, do you have any contact information, like a website or someplace where people could get in touch with you?
One of my sons made me a website called Allison Lurie. I'm thinking of maybe I should go on Facebook or LinkedIn. Do you think I should?
I think you should go on Facebook with just specifically with your book, and then you could talk
to
people.
Then I can go off it.
And then you could just keep it specific to your book. I think that's a good idea.
And if you just type in Facebook, they tell you how to do it?
That's right. It's real simple. It really is simple. But in the meantime, listeners, AllisonLurie.com is her website. And the book, again, is called The Language of Houses, How Buildings Speak to Us. Allison Lurie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.